You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. If you've ever had a stretch of your life where you feel empty, unmotivated, mentally weary, just kind of meh about life right now, you're not alone. Our next guest says it's a common state of mind called languishing, and he says there is a way to get from there back to flourishing. In his new book, he makes the case that we can boost our mental health and get out of languishing in part by rebuilding our connections with other people. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you now or at some point in your recent memory? Like you were going through the motions, unmotivated, tired, something's missing. If you've been there before, what did you do to get out of there, to shake that feeling? Join in with your thoughts or questions about languishing at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Corey Keyes is a sociologist and professor emeritus at Emory University. He hails from northern Wisconsin and is a graduate of UW-Eau Claire and UW-Madison. His newest book is called Languishing, How to Feel Alive Again in a World That Wears Us Down. Corey, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
I gave a very brief description there of languishing. Corey, can you flesh that out a little more? What are we talking about when we talk about languishing?
Well, I developed a questionnaire. Typical scientist, yes, that has 14 questions. And you have to have 7 out of those 14 as a minimum that are in terms you're missing at least some feeling good, what we call happiness or satisfaction, but at least 6 out of the 11 signs of functioning well, things like social contribution, sense of integration, warm, trusting relationships, and personal growth, just to give you a sense of what might be missing. Mm-hmm. So languishing is having a deficiency in the things that make life meaningful and interesting.
And people might hear some of this and think, oh, languishing is like depression. And there might be a bit of overlap, but you very carefully distinguish between the two in your book, Corey.
Yes. Depression and languishing are very distinctive in the sense that languishing is the absence of these questions that have to do with the presence of well-being. Well, of course, depression is that you have the presence of some very negative symptoms and signs of malfunctioning. And yet, when you're depressed, the chances are that to some degree you are languishing. And that level of languishing, whether it's mild, moderate, or severe, will also affect how well or how poorly you are functioning with your depression or anxiety. So languishing comes along with mental illnesses like anxiety and depression often, but its level will determine how poorly you function with your mental disorder.
And that leads to an important point in your book. A lot of times we treat mental health, I think professionally, just in how we talk about it, as, you know, you're mentally healthy if you don't have mental illness right now. You say no, mental health can be a positive description of a state of being. Make that distinction for us, please.
Sure. For a long time, and for good reason, we focused on mental illnesses, and they're very serious. And I'm not debating whether that's the case. Mm-hmm. I take them very serious myself. I suffer from depression and PTSD. But just because I have these moments when I'm free of symptoms and you know, I might not be clinically depressed, my level of good mental health will determine how well I'm functioning and how long I stay in recovery. But even if you're free of a mental illness, it doesn't mean you're anywhere close to what I call flourishing. You could be stuck somewhere in between, which I call languishing. And think of languishing as being mentally unhealthy. And I found in lots of research that being mentally unhealthy too long, staying languishing too long, actually puts you at risk for sliding into mental illnesses like depression.
Now, last time we talked, Corey, it was in one of the most serious stretches of COVID. Now, languishing was around a long time before COVID was, but did the pandemic cause a lot more of languishing?
Yes, I just read very new paper that showed that definitely in between 2019 and 2021, there was an increase in languishing. But I found it interesting. This was a study of clergy, Methodist clergy in North Carolina. And what they found was that if the clergy were mentally healthy, that is flourishing before the pandemic hit, they were protected from becoming depressed or anxious. But if they were languishing to some degree before the pandemic, they were much more likely during the pandemic to become depressed or anxious. So the rise in mental illnesses that we were seeing may be attributable to the degree to which people were languishing before the pandemic.
Corey Keyes is with us. We're talking about his new book. It's called Languishing, How to Feel Alive Again in a World That Wears Us Down. Talk about what languishing is, what it does to us, and in a bit, we'll talk about how to break out of it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Corey, in your book, you look at a lot of individual strategies to deal with languishing. But before we get there, I want to get to this part in your subtitle there, A World That Wears Us Down. Have we developed, created a society in some ways that steers us toward languishing and away from the positive behaviors that can get us out of it?
I think yes is the and for the reason that both young people in college as well as adults talk a lot about time deficiency or being time exhausted, that there's never enough time to get everything done. And this is this condition of always running behind can really lead to a sense of emptiness because you barely have time to get the work done. And what's left over is probably a sense that I want to disconnect and have some downtime rather than prioritize the things that go into what I'm calling the five vitamins for flourishing. So I think people are really running ragged and running on empty, much like I opened my book when I heard that song as a young teenager. I too felt that there simply wasn't enough time in the day to get everything done. And when the day was finished and I had a period to stop and rest, a sense of emptiness set in, much like a fog.
You mentioned those five vitamins. I want to key in on one of them, connect, the idea of connecting with other people in meaningful ways. And you mentioned our feeling of being stretched thin on time. I think for me, and I'm guessing for a lot of people, that's one of the things that can sometimes fall by the wayside. There's time for work and maybe for family and some downtime. And those connections with friends and others is something we often sacrifice. How important is that?
Very important. In fact, I was reading a very recent Deloitte consulting firm survey of workers, and almost 50% of the workers they surveyed said they don't have enough time for family and friends. And that stood out to me because often, not for everyone, but often those are one of the most rewarding relationships that we leave behind in the pursuit of doing more and more at work and trying to succeed there. And so we tend not to prioritize those close, warm, trusting relationships. And when that happens, I think this sense of disconnection from them, as well as a disconnection from our own sense of self, begins to creep in.
Give us a little prescription here. How good a medicine is rebuilding those connections if we're in that state of languishing?
Well, when I talk about connection, I'm not just talking about quantity. And more and more people are making that point. It's about quality in the following sense. Three ingredients that lead to flourishing have to do with relationships. The first, of course, is that you really develop and have warm, trusting relationships with others. The second is that you have a sense of mattering or contributing things of worth to your community and other people. In other words, you're needed by other people and asked to help. And the third is that you have this sense of belonging to a community. A lot of us are situated in institutions and neighborhoods and departments, but you may not feel you belong or are accepted there. So we need to work on belonging. We need to work on our sense of mattering to the world and other people, along with warm, trusting relationships.
We're talking to Corey Keyes about his new book, Languishing, How to Feel Alive Again in a World That Wears Us Down. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Now, maybe this concept, this label of languishing is new to you. The feelings that Corey described, does it sound familiar to you now or at some point in your life? What do you see leading to that sense of languishing? Did you have things that you found that got you out of it? Do you embrace things like making time for those important relationships, friendships, and things like that? Do you take time to learn new things, to play? Those are a couple of the other things that help break out of languishing. Join in with your thoughts, your experiences, your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Corey Keyes, author of the new book, Languishing, How to Feel Alive Again in a World That Wears Us Down. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Just heard that clip from Running on Empty by Jackson Brown. Do you feel that sense that you are running on empty? Does your work time or other obligations get in the way of things like connecting with friends, having hobbies, having fun in your life? Do you feel like you are languishing? Have you felt that way in the past? You're getting out of it now. Does it sound easier said than done to rebuild those relationships given the way the world works now? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Corey, you had referenced that Jackson Brown song as something that you, in your younger days, that was something that captured this feeling of languishing for you. Could you talk a little bit about that as part of your inspiration for, well, not just this book, but for your career?
Yes, it started me down this path. I was one Sunday evening, I turned on the radio and got the King Biscuit Flower Hour tuned in from Wausau, and there was Jackson Brown doing a concert. And this song comes on. I'm lying on my bed in Three Lakes, Wisconsin, staring at the ceiling, feeling that kind of restless, empty feeling. And Running on Empty comes on. And for the first time, I feel like somebody out there knows what I'm feeling. I'm not alone. And I must say, it was a haunting feeling to be there in Three Lakes, Wisconsin, a small town, beautiful area. But yet there I was. I felt empty, alone, and like something was really missing. And there was a void. And then I heard that song and I thought, maybe others are out there thinking and feeling the same way. And it took a while to get through college and then get my PhD, but I was committed to understanding whether this sense of emptiness was affecting other people along with me.
And you've learned, of course, that it is. You share a story through the course of your book about a prison guard in Australia named Scott at a low point in his life, just off a divorce. Definitely feeling like he was running on empty, disconnected to the world. Along comes a mandatory mental wellness session that he very much doesn't want to go. Pick up the story there, Corey.
Yes. He was jaded, to put it mildly. And he thought, here is another waste of my time and the waste of our prisoners' time. To think that there was a waste of prisoners' time was ironic, to say the least. And he didn't want to show up for the program. But he had a friend, and I talk about her, and she was really important to his transformation, because that connection that he had, which was a warm, trusting relationship he had with a colleague, she said, come on, Scott, what do we have to lose? Come with me. We'll do this together. And I think that's important when we talk about the vitamins. Don't think you have to do these things alone. Like Scott, it took somebody else to say, I'll come along with you and we will do this together. And Scott was catapulted over time. He started to realize what he was learning for his job was very relevant to his own situation, how he could dig himself out of this hole that he came to understand was languishing. And suddenly by the end of the story, there he is wanting to bring this to the prisoners and help transform their lives. And that's where I would like to follow up with Scott to see how that's going. He was a prisoner guard in a women's prison in Australia. And the moral of the story is suddenly when he was flourishing, he couldn't keep it to himself. He wanted to give it away to the others and share it. And so Scott is an inspiration, if you ask me, to anybody, because he was going through a lot and he ended up flourishing and wanting to share it with others.
And between your story of working with your own sense of languishing by trying to help others and Scott's, one of the most potent ways to get out of languishing, it seems, is to find purpose in life by helping others. How important is that?
Very important. And before we even talk about purpose, I want to dial it back, because I think for people, when they hear purpose in life, they think it's pretty overwhelming and that there's one purpose for them out there waiting for them to find. It's like a needle in the haystack. Start small and start local and just focus on where and who you want to help. Helping other people or helping something in the world improve is a great way to begin your journey out of languishing. It even helps people. The research shows that if you're not languishing, but you're depressed as well, people who are depressed who engage in more helping behavior begin to have better days. And as they have better days, they begin to move up the measurement tool that towards flourishing. It doesn't happen overnight. It takes a couple months, just like Scott. But you begin to have a taste of better days, and it pulls you forward. So helping is really important. And you can take that to the level of saying, this is my purpose in life. I'm going to dedicate a part of my life to a cause. And I want to leave that part of the world a better place because I was here. You can get there, but start just with helping someone, something in the world.
Corey Keyes is with us, sociologist, author of the new book, Languishing, How to Feel Alive Again in a World That Wears Us Down. Corey, a lot of people might try to get out of languishing by setting their goal as happiness and trying to be happy. You say that might not be the best lighthouse to seek. Why is that?
Yes. Oh boy. Don't get me in trouble here, because happiness report just came out and we always want to talk about happiness, but I'm here to tell you, I think sometimes you can put happiness as the horse before the cart, or the cart before the horse, however it goes. in the following way, I surveyed my college students, and all the qualities of flourishing, they put happiness as number one, the most important thing that would be part of their life moving forward. They put psychological and social well-being, things like belonging, sense of self-acceptance, as dead last. And I'm here to tell you, there's over 20% of college students who would be flourishing in terms of happiness, but they're not functioning well. And they have over 3 to 4 times the rate of mental illness than the college students who are flourishing, meaning they put together a life where they're feeling good about it because they're functioning well. So feeling happy isn't enough if it's not tethered or a result of feeling the things that go into functioning well, like purpose, belonging, and contribution, and growth, and a sense of mastery.
What is it about happiness? You actually have an exercise in the book where you assign your students to go out and try to be happy for an X period of time. Why do they always fail?
Because they fall for the I don't know what you would call it. It's a perennial problem. It's not new to us. People have been doing this throughout for decades. And they forget that emotions were meant to be very time limited, short lived. I use the analogy, it's like that windsock out there on the landing field for planes. It blows in multiple directions wherever the wind is blowing. And so they go out there and try to keep their happiness alive for over an hour. And almost everyone, literally everyone, fails. And they come back to me complaining, like they said, you set us up. And I said, no, this is an important lesson. If you're only focused on happiness, you will never, ever be able to sustain it because it's never meant to last. It's supposed to be a result of something. That's why prioritizing functioning well, putting purpose in your life, putting a sense of contribution in your life, putting a sense that you're accepting of other people or yourself first, that it will create a feeling of happiness about something that's worth being happy.
In just our last minute or so, Corey, imagine someone out there listening who feels that languishing. They hear us talking about it and they say, yeah, I think that's me. Can you offer a few first steps to go from there to flourishing?
Well, in addition to helping others and socializing and connecting, there are three other vitamins for flourishing. I think you mentioned this third one, which was just learn something new and get engaged in learning something new simply for your own sake, not for work or advancing at work, just because you enjoy and you want to see yourself grow. You could also add the vitamin of spirituality or religion, which is engage in activities and rituals, but don't do just the physical stuff. Also study the philosophy, which tends to emphasize more ethical principles in life and better ways to live. And last but not least, I think you also mentioned it, play. Play more and engage in what is called active leisure. Too many of us are doing leisure passively, which is we sit on our couch and our chairs and we consume it. We don't do it. So active leisure and play. Start with just one of the vitamins and start small, but do it more regularly. And you just might begin to experience better days that move you closer and closer to on the path to flourishing.
Thanks to our guest, Corey Keyes, is a sociologist and professor emeritus at Emory University. His new book is called Languishing, How to Feel Alive Again in a World That Wears Us Down. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A new report finds that most countries do not meet the World Health Organization standard for fine particulate matter, which is the most deadly form of air pollution. The report included 134 countries and territories. Only seven met those standards in a review of 2023 data by the Swiss company IQ Air. Wisconsin shows up in the study not in a good way. Beloit, for some reason, appeared with the highest levels of particulates in the U.S., the most polluted major U.S. city is also in the Midwest, Columbus, Ohio. So is this a problem that can be solved? What does it all mean for our health? You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you or someone in your family have asthma or other respiratory illness where air quality is a really important issue for you? Are you worried about air pollution? How has it affected your life? Do you want to see changes in the way it's regulated? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Gage Kerr is a senior research scientist at the Milken Institute School of Public Health at George Washington University. Gage grew up in Wisconsin. Gage, welcome back to Wisconsin.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
First of all, what is fine particulate matter and why do we worry about it?
Fine particulate matter, which I'll try to always say, but in the event I abbreviate it, it's abbreviated PM2.5, and it's a pollutant that's very common throughout urban areas and even rural areas. It's kind of a catch-all term. Many different components or species can be considered fine particulate matter. So it's almost like saying, I'm having a cookie, right? We don't know if it's an Oreo, if it's grandma's homemade cookie, or what kind of cookie it is. And in the same vein, particulate matter can be comprised of pollution that comes from, say, a car's exhaust. It could also be coming from agriculture or even natural sources like dust and sea salt.
The concern, I guess, is this is stuff that our lungs don't want, whatever the source. What kind of health impact does it have?
Yes, you are correct. Studies time and time again have demonstrated this very pronounced and robust link between particulate matter exposure and a number of adverse health outcomes. some of those health outcomes are admittedly not as serious as others. So particulate matter, for example, can lead to respiratory infections, asthma exacerbations. So I'm not trying to downplay those, of course, but on the flip side of the spectrum, you have a lot of research that's shown that prolonged exposure to particulate matter can lead to premature death.
This new report out, now this is one company looking at monitoring data around the world. They acknowledge there are some gaps. Not every place is measuring this well enough. But the big takeaway, this is a problem in many, if not most, places on our planet. Why do we do so poorly?
Well, we humans like to burn fossil fuels, right? We need fossil fuels, at least currently, to power our homes, businesses, to drive cars. And unfortunately, a byproduct of fossil fuel combustion is pollution. So this, at the end of the day, just traces back to our consumption of fossil fuels. Now, there are some particulate matter sources that are beyond just fossil fuel combustion. So particulate matter, I didn't mention this before, but it can also arise from things like wildfires, which we know are increasing in a rapidly warming world. So at the end of the day, again, this ubiquitous or very common particulate matter throughout global cities can be traced back to largely fossil fuel consumption.
There are different standards at play. This used the World Health Organization guideline, which I believe is 5 micrograms of fine particulate matter, I think, per year. Correct me if I have it wrong. Here in the U.S., our EPA guidelines, not 5, but 12, but considering bringing it down to 9. What do you make of those differing standards here in the U.S. versus the World Health Organization?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So I think part of the difference in the World Health Organization's versus our EPA standards, we can think about in the context of what they represent. So the World Health Organization has guidelines, right? They're not legally binding their guidelines. And as a result of those guidelines and the scientists who have worked behind the scenes to produce them, that team of individuals has concluded that we should really aim for 5 micrograms. It's per cubic meter,
right,
which is
I skipped that part. Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of an obscure unit. In the US, we have standards and they are enforced by the EPA. So they have a little bit more teeth to them. They're legally binding in some senses. So the standards reflect what is maybe more feasible to achieve or attain. So it's not that one is right or one is wrong. It more comes down to what is actually possible and what can we, and by we I'm talking about the EPA and enforcement agencies, what can we actually attain in a certain jurisdiction?
How much control can a local jurisdiction have over this? We might be able to say, okay, this particulate matters from that highway over there or that coal power plant over here. But as you mentioned, it might be from a wildfire in another country thousands of miles to the west. Do we control our own destiny that well when it comes to this kind of pollution?
I'll give you maybe a politician answer, yes and no. In some senses, yes. If we were to shut off, let's say, cars and factories in city X or Y, there would be immediate local decreases in air pollution. But you're right in that lots of our air pollution is transported by the atmosphere. So wind and pressure differences, meteorology, allow pollution to be transported oftentimes hundreds, maybe even thousands of miles away from where it's emitted. So I think this underscores that air is a shared resource, right? Unlike some other things, whether it be our own land or maybe our water, where there are kind of clear boundaries or watersheds, air is, again, a shared resource. And as we think about controlling pollution, I think it's important to think about that aspect of air. And in the US in particular, there are some things that people refer to as good neighbor clauses, right? That states downwind of a particular state are going to bear the consequences of air pollution in an upwind state. So we should be coordinating across states, across jurisdictions to try to do mitigation strategies and air pollution reduction strategies in concert with one another.
Talking to senior research scientist Gage Kerr at George Washington University about air quality, a new international report finds most Almost all countries around the world have concerning levels of particulate matter in their air, at least some of the time. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Gage, I wanted to ask about some of your work on who is affected the most by various kinds of air pollution. Obviously, air can go anywhere, but the health impacts are not necessarily evenly distributed. Who tends to suffer the worst consequences?
In my research, I largely focus on the US, and what research that I've led, along with research that countless others have pioneered, has shown is that, unfortunately, marginalized groups in the US face the highest levels of air pollution and associated health damages. So when I say marginalized groups, I'm talking about communities that have low wealth or low socioeconomic status, as well as Black and Brown communities. And this co-location of marginalization and higher pollution is rooted, unfortunately, in history. Perhaps some listeners have heard of redlining and other racist land use practices and zoning practices that occurred many decades ago, but they still have real world consequences for how air pollution is distributed within our cities and within our country.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Ruth is with us in Milwaukee. Ruth, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Ruth?
I'm going to read a poem that I wrote about air.
Okay, go ahead.
The air we breathe. Ah, air is so good and so fresh. But sometimes the air we breathe is toxic. Some people struggle to breathe. Toxic air is like an electric collar. It chokes you. Why does this happen? Three words: climate change, global warming, and humans. The last one probably shocks you. But yes, humans pollute Mother Earth's air. Would she be better off without us? That's a question I ponder about. Some people say that they believe we fight for clean air, but they don't really know what it means. They procrastinate and put profit over our well-being. They know that Mother Earth's clean air is in danger, but they don't want to help. Does that even make sense to you? It doesn't to me.
Ruth, thank you for reading that. Can I ask, Ruth, how old you are?
I'm 11 years old.
All right. Ruth, thank you for calling in and sharing your poem about clean air. Gage, stepping outside of the research into the humanities there, but did Ruth capture, you think, some of the causes and concerns about what you're researching?
Yeah, for sure. I don't know if you're still on, Ruth, but hi. Thanks for sharing that poem. That was lovely. I agree with the poem and the sentiment behind it. I think it's important to remember, too, that while it's easy to maybe get depressed or sad about air pollution and toxic pollution, you know, you mentioned something that you wonder if Mother Earth is better off without us. I might have gotten that quote wrong, but I think what we have to remember is that we have solutions, and they're not pie in the sky. We still need to research them for decades. Solutions, they're solutions that we have at our disposal now, that if we implemented them, we could see really immediate and important decreases in air quality. So I hope that people like you, Ruth, and you know, your classmates and friends can grow up to be advocates for clean air and a healthier environment for all people.
Ruth, thanks again for sharing that with us. We're talking to Gage Kerr, senior research scientist at the Milken Institute School of Public Health at George Washington University, looking at a new report finding that most countries do not meet the World Health Organization standards for fine particulate matter. United States does not. Our standards are a little different. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the U.S. should have stricter standards for air pollution? Do you have questions for our guest about research on this issue? Do you see concerns in your community about racial disparities, socioeconomic disparities in how people are exposed to air pollution? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Gage Kerr, senior research scientist at the Milken Institute School of Public Health at George Washington University, looking at a report finding that most countries around the world, including the U.S., don't meet a key World Health Organization benchmark when it comes to clean air. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about how air pollution affects our health? What can be done to mitigate some of those problems? Is this a particular concern for you or someone in your family? Are you vulnerable when we have bad air days? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. Gage, in answering Ruth's poem there, you talked about solutions that we know, and you've started to touch on them a little bit. Talk about some of the things we could do to cut back, especially on this particulate matter in our air.
I think the answer depends exactly where you live. Maybe I'll first start by talking about urban areas, then we can talk about rural areas too. In urban areas, a lot of this fine particulate matter comes from traffic and from industry. And there are many solutions that we have at our fingertips to reduce pollution from these sources. Things like active transit, so walking, riding your bike, are some ways to reduce fine particulate matter. Also, increased public transit would be another way to reduce fine particulate matter. But having grown up in rural Wisconsin, I understand that a small unincorporated town is not going to put in a metro system or light rail, obviously. So there are some other ways that we can be cognizant of ways of life and culture to get at this common goal that we should all have of making the air healthier for everyone. So in rural areas, we can maybe think about energy sources. I know that wood burning is quite common in rural Wisconsin. And on one hand, wood burning is great because it, in theory, reduces fossil fuel consumption that folks otherwise might be using natural gas or coal or oil to heat their homes. But wood burning has its own issues associated with it, mainly air pollution. So it'd be great moving forward if we could move towards more sustainable forms of heating our homes and powering our homes. Maybe solar panels, wind, et cetera.
Let's talk a little bit about other forms of air pollution. When, you know, during wildfire season, when I've been obsessively monitoring air quality, there's always the listing for particulate matter and then for ozone levels. And that's caused by companies and things like that don't release ozone directly, I understand, but chemicals that lead to ozone creation. How big a concern is that? How well are we doing at trying to control it?
Yeah, ozone, as you mentioned, is an interesting pollutant. The ingredients to make ozone are emitted oftentimes in cities, but oftentimes we find the highest ozone concentrations in suburban or even rural areas because ozone chemistry takes time and space in our atmosphere. So you asked how we're doing with ozone. Thankfully, in much of the U.S., our ozone standards set by the EPA to protect public health are being met. So that's good news. Still, though, we as epidemiologists and environmental health scientists have detected impacts that ozone has on public health, even at concentrations or levels below the EPA standards. So there's more work that we could be doing to reduce pollution that leads to ozone formation. And a lot of those solutions also trace back to some of the solutions I mentioned a few minutes ago regarding traffic and industry.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Rich is with us now in Two Rivers. Rich, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me on. Hey, I was kind of curious. I grew up in New York City in the 60s as a kid and the 70s, and I saw the transition the government made with doing away with the leaded gas and catalytic converters. Mm-hmm. And I've seen some of the changes that have the government has made in other instances regarding pollution controls, and some of them they went back on their word and they went back on the law. My question is, in today's political atmosphere, would changes that have been made back then, such as catalytic converters, if it would have cost big corporations money, would they have elected to go otherwise than what the decision they made for our health and for the environment?
Rich, thanks for the call. Gage, I've seen the examples he gave, ending leaded gas, catalytic converters, also efforts to deal with the hole in the ozone layer as success stories of cooperation regulation in the past. Is that era over? I think Rich is kind of asking.
Yeah, well, let me start this by saying this gets out of my area of expertise and research, but thanks for your question, Rich. I think what you described underscores to me the importance of really robust top-down regulations. The purpose, in my opinion, of a company or corporation is to maximize profit, right? I know that sometimes gets demonized, but at the end of the day, companies want to make a profit, and that's fine. I think what that means, though, is that as a society, we should have rules on how they go about making profit, and they cannot make profit at the expense of harming human health. So I'm not exactly sure if some of the really positive actions that happened back in the 60s, 70s, even 80s would happen now. But again, I think this underscores to me the importance of having these kind of checks and balances from the government where, yes, you can go about your business, you can make money, but you have to do so in a way that protects the air we breathe and the health of those who breathe it.
Thanks, Rich, for that call. We are talking to Gage Kerr from George Washington University, senior research scientist in public health, looking at air pollution. Big study finds that most countries are not meeting at least World Health Organization standards when it comes to particulate matter. Back to your calls now. Silas is with us in Green Bay. Silas, hi. Silas, are you there?
Correct.
Yeah, Silas, what did you want to tell us about?
Some people, okay, many companies have decided to use plastics and other things that can pollute and hurt a lot of communities, but not everybody can actually afford other fresh produce and healthier things. Yet, when they produce these cheap plastics, it can pollute. Like, factories can pollute the air, and companies sometimes try to take advantage over people who don't have as much money.
Silas, can I ask how old you are, Silas?
I am 9 years old.
Nine. Okay, the youth coming out big time for Central Time today. Thanks for calling in, Silas. Silas mentioned plastics production, Gage. How big a factor is that in air pollution?
Yeah, well, first, thank you, Silas, for sharing those thoughts. It's great to have so much youth input on this call. Generally, scientists think about plastic pollution a little bit differently than air pollution, but what is common between those two forms of pollution is that they can have consequences on health and ecosystems. And sometimes these pollutants, even though they're different, can come from the same sources. You know, for example, I think Silas mentioned factories. Factories can pollute the air, right? But they can also pollute the water and have waste runoff. So I think this stresses the importance of thinking holistically that air pollution doesn't exist in isolation, soil pollution doesn't exist in isolation, but all these environmental contaminants can co-occur.
And Silas also points us towards something we talked about earlier, Gage, the uneven impacts. Lower income people may not be able to afford to move out of that high pollution area. If there are filters and mitigation, things that might help with particular kinds of pollution, they might not be able to afford that. That points back to your research on the unequal impacts. Can you talk about that a bit more in just our last minute?
Sure. I think I'll maybe rephrase this. Instead of talking about unequal impacts, I think it's cool to talk about opportunities too. And in this sense, I'm really excited that some of the recent measures put forth by the Biden-Harris administration have been cognizant of these income and socioeconomic differences. So there are opportunities now for communities of low wealth to have greater access to monitors, to monitor the air they breathe, and have greater accesses to resources to try to mitigate or reduce pollution. And so that gives me hope that even though there are these really stark differences in income and access to commodities, that the government's cognizant of them and doing things to try to even the playing field to make sure that everyone is not just breathing clean air, but has access to things like electric cars and heat pumps to try to reduce air pollution.
Silas, thanks for that call. And Gage, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Gage Kerr is a senior research scientist at the Milken Institute School of Public Health at George Washington University. He talked to us about new research finding that most places in the world don't meet a key benchmark for clean air. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, an animal hospital in Spooner treats injured raptors like hawks, owls, and eagles and works to release them into the wild. Go behind the scenes with a veterinarian and join in with your questions tomorrow morning at 7:30. That's here on the Ideas Network. I got around to seeing the new Dune movie last weekend in an actual theater. I've read the book and some of the sequels. Movie was pretty good. If you haven't seen or read it, a lot of the action revolves around this substance called spice or melange. People consume it to, among other things, live longer, see the future, that sort of thing. One thing you got to wonder is, what does that spice taste like? A fantasy science fiction cook tried to create the flavor. The creators of the Inn at the Crossroads website tried to do this, replicate foods in fantasy and science fiction books and movies, including a Game of Thrones, the source of their name. In a post a couple years back, I just saw it, they gave a recipe for the spice from Dune. The book says it smells like cinnamon, so that's the starting ingredient. Takes it off the table for me. Cinnamon does bad stuff to Rob. Then you add in turmeric, ginger, cumin, and cloves, then some less common spices that I don't know about, grains of paradise, ground malep, and jaggery, and round it out with a pinch of edible luster powder for a magical glow. This might not be something for everyday cooking, given that some of those spices are hard to find. Perfect for your Dune-themed party. Who controls the cinnamon, controls the universe. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now you are our guest. Here's the deal. Whether you got tons of snow or gallons of rain over the last couple of few days, it's been indoor weather in Wisconsin, for a lot of the state anyway. That got us talking and thinking about indoor activities like board games. There are a lot of big fans here at Central Time and WPR, and we wondered, what are you playing? Now we are asking you, what is your favorite board game of all time or of the last month? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. You can call in with a classic or something off the beaten path, and we can accept a broad definition of board games. We'll take card games, parlor games, even tabletop role-playing games if you want. Do you play in person and or online? Join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. As always, when we do this kind of thing, we asked our colleagues here at Wisconsin Public Media. Jason Butler, executive assistant, the executive director of WPM, told us how his family plays the game of life.
The most fun we've had with board games lately is reworking the rules for the game of life. We have a really elaborate set of house rules that we have put into place. We have a whole separate way of scoring for like social wellness. And it also involves the special fun of being able to have pets in the game. And we used post-it notes to like create special pet cards. And, you know, so you can get cats and dogs and snakes and hamsters and fun things like that. So the game of life is really open to just having fun house rules.
Now you could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a big board game fan, like hardcore, like me? I've actually pared down my collection a little bit, but it's still a lot. Or is there a casual fun game, or have you, like Jason, made your own house rules to any particular games? You are our guest as we talk about our favorite board games and things in that neighborhood at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Terry is with us in Viroqua. Terry, hi.
Hi there.
Hi, what's your game, Terry?
Settlers of Catan is my all-time fave.
How long have you been playing it?
I don't know, probably at least a decade.
Okay. And do you have a crew that you play with, your family or a group of friends?
Not a lot more right now because I've got two little ones.
Oh.
But the oldest is getting to the age I think maybe we might start being able to play with him.
That's the dream. Yeah, my gaming took a hit when I had little kids, but for about a 10-year stretch there, I had buddies to play games with. Are you hoping you could bring them up that way, Terry?
I'm hoping, yeah.
All right. Terry, thank you so much for sharing that at 800-642-1234. You could join in with your favorite board game and what you love about it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Joy Ratchkramer from our Wausau Bureau, producer of Route 51, had a story. You wouldn't think a game about planting beans would be, well, anyone's cup of tea, but everyone I've played Bonanza with absolutely loves it, from casual players to hardcore tabletop fanatics. Bona is the German word for bean, Bonanza. It is a cutthroat game of set building, trading, and negotiation, featuring endearingly pun-tastic illustrations. Joy says it's a fixture in my family whenever card games are appropriate. Thanks, Joy, for that at 800-642-1234. I have played that in the Game of Life, and Settlers of Catan for that matter. My latest new one, I mentioned I've been purging some board games. I go to a game store and I trade them in, and like, you could take cash or you get a little more store credit. So I've built up a backlog. Everdell is the newest one I cracked open. I'm looking forward to teaching that to people. And of course, my regular go-to card game is Pinochle, which I play in person or online with my parents. We just go, you know, on Discord and a website and play all the Pinochle we want. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Matt is with us in Madison. Matt, hi.
Yeah, hi. I like to play pool, and it's not exactly a board game.
Works for me.
But... there's a lot of great pool players in Wisconsin, and not just a bar scene either. I'm lucky enough to have a table at my house, and I spend at least 10 hours a week playing with a couple of different buddies of mine, and we have great fun sessions. We don't gamble. We're competitive with each other. And
well, Matt, Wisconsin has a big tradition. I used to work at my uncle's swimming pool and pool table show back in Michigan, and Wisconsin is the home of at least a couple of Q-Stick manufacturers, right? This is a big thing in the state.
More than a couple. Pound for pound, Wisconsin is one of the heaviest pool states out there, I would say.
Now, Matt, you play with your buddies, and that's great at home. Do you ever go out to a club and, you know, take on strangers?
Yeah, I play down in Beloit quite a bit. There's a pool hall there called the Carom Room that's really a great pool hall. And I play in some tournaments also. I'm nothing special, but it's, as a 50-year-old dude, it's something that I can compete at and have some fun. So,
excellent.
Yeah.
Matt, thank you so much for sharing this. Sharing that. That's great. I used to play a lot because I had an uncle in the business, actually. A lot doesn't mean I ever got good at it. Streaky, I would say. Like, sometimes I could look like a star for three shots in a row, and then the truth would shine through. Thanks for the call, Matt, at 800-642-1234. Matthew joins us now in Verona. Matthew, hi.
Hey there, how's it going?
Good, what's your game?
Well, I mean, it's hard to pick from all the different games I play, but one I've been enjoying recently is a card game called Anomia. Yeah, it's just a simple little word game that I've been able to play with all age demographics, and it's been a blast.
Yeah, I've played that. I don't have it anymore, but it's got little patterns on it, and it's got like words with cues on them, right? And you have to come up with something in that category, but on the spot, which is what makes it tricky, right?
Yeah, exactly. The categories are so dumb simple. It's like name an animal, but because it's pitting people against each other and it's on the spot, you just start flubbing and you say the wrong things, and it's just hilarious. And it's just it's been a delight that I've been able to introduce to with everyone.
Wonderful. Anomia is the game, Matthew. Thanks a lot for sharing that with us. We are taking your calls, your favorite board games or card games or activities in that neighborhood. You could join in at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Let's go back to your calls. Susan is with us now in Fitchburg. Hi there, Susan.
Hi.
What game did you want to share with us?
Yeah, this is a game that hardly anybody I ever talked to has ever heard of this game, but it is so fun. It's called Wits and Wages, mm-hmm. and it's a board game, and all the answers are numerical, are numbers. And it's a guessing game where there are questions laid out. Everybody puts their best guess forward. You put the numbers on a board, and then you can bet. You can place bets on which answer you think is the closest. It's really fun, and the questions are really off the wall, like how much does a baby elephant weigh? You know, things that the normal person might not know, but then you all guess, and then you wager on which guess you think is best,
right.
And then you get chips. It's a really fun game, and all ages can play.
I have played this a lot, Susan, with my family. It's great for a big group of people. It's pretty fast and easy, and it looks like it's going to be a trivia game, but you hit the point there. It's questions that nobody, for the most part, is going to know the actual answer to. It's about betting who came the closest. I think that's what makes it so fun. It's not, you don't have to know anything.
Yeah, exactly.
Susan, thank you so much for calling in at 800-642-1234. Kathy is with us now in Middleton. Kathy, hi, what do you want to tell us about?
Well, first of all, I desperately need a place to play board games because my source has dried up on me. But my game is UBI, spelled U-B-I. It's a trivia game, a little like Trivial Pursuit, but it is so bizarre. You start out with a world map that doesn't have any boundaries, no rivers, no delineations at all. And then what you end up having to do is answer a question, ubi something weird. And then you have to locate it in a map, and then you have to get a little doohickey that you put on your marker, and it's difficult. You have to be smart. You have to be challenged. And it can take forever. It can take a short period of time, and it's absolutely delightful.
I love it.
And I love it too. It's hard to find. I had to get mine through some sort of an online source because apparently it dried up. Now they're just. My board game group has dried up on me, and I am looking for a place to play board games.
Kathy, good luck. I say I love the concept. I have not played UBI. You've got at least one game store, actually two or three, if you don't mind a bit of a drive, Kathy. I hit the, I guess the internet. I was going to say phone book. They don't even have those anymore. Kathy, thanks a lot for that call. We are taking your calls with your favorite board games. You could join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We are taking your calls with your favorite games, board games, card games, tabletop role-playing games, you name it. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We asked around here at WPR. Trina LaSousa, an audio production engineer, says, I really like Wingspan. It's got amazing artwork of birds. I feel like I learn a new bird fact each time I play. Trina says it's very accessible. I've played it with people who don't play games often, and they enjoyed it. Wingspan is a great game and really beautiful. Unsurprisingly, good pictures of birds in it. Now back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Nick is with us now in Beloit. Nick, hi.
Hey, I found these two games from this artist in Wisconsin named John Kovalik.
Sure.
There's one called War Hamster Rally. It's basically a board game version of Mario Kart, but you're riding hamsters, just giant hamsters. It's really weird, but really funny. And he also has attached this game called Pairs. That's also fantastic, where you're trying to avoid getting pairs. And apart from that, anything that's attached to, Mensa, so it's great. They allow you to play those over at Pegasus Games Game Store in off of Odana in Madison, as well as Planet Chaos in Fort Atkinson.
Nick, thanks a lot for the great recommendations. Yeah, John Kovalik, he's been a guest on this show from time to time, big name in the game industry. If you've played Apples to Apples, you've seen some of his work. Thanks a lot for that call, Nick, at 800-642-1234. Completely unrelated to that, our own Judith Heise, digital marketing manager here, says, my husband was at a gaming convention in Atlanta last week called Nerdy Gras, and Judith and her husband played a party game called Fill in the Game. Judith says it's a challenge game where the players get to fill in a component of the challenge. Like the card says, do a plank for 30 seconds while you blank. The player challenges another player to do the thing and fill in the blank. I challenged my husband to quote Shakespeare while doing that plank. He did it and earned the points. Judith was telling me about this game the other day, Fill in the Game. Sounds like a lot of fun. I could do without the planking, though. Back to your calls with your favorite board games at 800-642-1234. Glenn is with us now in Fox Lake. Glenn, what are your games?
Well, tonight we've got seven guys playing Cheapshead. We play from 6:30 to 9:30. We switch houses. 9 o'clock, whoever's house it is, they have a dessert. And then in 2 weeks from now, we play poker with the same group. And before COVID, we had about 14 guys in a cribbage tournament.
Wow.
So that's my three games.
That's great. And is it the same group playing the sheep's head and the poker and back with that cribbage tournament?
No, not the cribbage, but just the poker.
Gotcha. I got to ask, sheep's head, I played it a couple times. You got seven people. Can you play seven-handed sheep's head, or are you splitting into a four and a three?
No, we play five-handed, and then the dealer sits. And then if there's seven, then there's two times the dealer sits.
Excellent. Okay.
And we play 25 cents, double on the bump, 25, 50, 75.
High stakes.
So if you get Schneider, you get Schneider and you pick, you double.
Okay. Glenn, thanks a lot for sharing this. I've played a little bit of sheep's head. In my head, it's in the same category as Pinochle, which is my card game. But sheep's head is great too. Glenn, thanks a lot for sharing that at 800-642-1234. Pam joins us now in Muscadet. Pam, what's your game?
Hi there. When we were kids, we had the most fun playing spoons. And even as an adult, especially if there's a few cocktails involved, playing spoons with your friends is still just as much fun.
Now, wait, have you turned spoons into a drinking game with those cocktails, or you just happen to be doing the two things at the same time?
It's pretty much a simultaneous
Excellent.
Thing.
Okay. Pam, so spoons, I feel like as a kid I played a game called Spoons. What do you do with the spoons?
So if you have five people, you put four spoons in the middle of the table.
Yeah.
And then you have a deck of cards and you shuffle them and the dealer starts by picking up a card, passing it to the next person. And you're trying to get four of a kind. And the first person to get four of a kind very quietly grabs a spoon. And it's kind of like musical chairs. The last person doesn't get a spoon and they're out.
Got it. Okay. Thanks a lot for sharing that. Yeah, I have definitely played spoons and an Italian card game is kind of like that. Porco, pig. Where when the thing happens, you slam your hand down in the middle of the table. There were injuries involved when multiple people tried to do it at the same time. Pam, thanks for sharing that. We are taking your favorite games at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Molly Gardner, our Eau Claire regional manager, says, a great way to talk about my board game obsession. The one that's been on my heavy rotation lately has been a little game called Dinosaur Tea Party, which is as ridiculous as it sounds. Think of Guess Who? But with dinosaurs, each character picks a dinosaur they will be. All the cards are faced up. The dinosaurs have special characteristics, and then you are guessing. Oh, and you have to have a funny British accent, I guess, because it's a tea party. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. We've got Dwayne with us in Westfield. What game did you want to tell us about, Dwayne?
When I was growing up, it was always Star Wars Monopoly.
All right, what was obviously the locations are different. Park Place is going to be something different. Was there other stuff that's different compared to original Monopoly?
Well, you get to buy the Death Star and you get to buy other planets. And, I mean, a bunch of other fun stuff. I mean, as being a kid growing up, you didn't get much of a chance to, I mean, enjoy your favorite films. And that was the closest thing we got to it.
Now, if you owned Death Star and somebody else owned Alderaan, could you blow up Alderaan, Dwayne?
Yes, we could.
Excellent. Or horrifying. Yeah, I'm not sure which.
Well, it was fun. I mean, we would play for hours on end, but God, it's been such a long time since I played that. I miss it.
Well, I bet you could find copies at like Goodwills and stuff like that, Dwayne. Go hunting. Thanks a lot for sharing that with us at 800-642-1234. Taking your favorite board games of all time, your childhood, or maybe something you've got geared up to play tonight or this weekend. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Let's go back to your calls now. We've got Brian with us in Cottage Grove. Brian, what are you playing these days? Are you there, Brian? Sounds like Brian's on the road. Nope, I don't think we're going to get Brian. Brian was going to mention getting a note from a producer. Oh, the game Azul. I have played that. It's like, it's really cool looking. It's got these tiles, I think inspired by Portugal. I'm going to say, I don't remember exactly which, but you have to put them down in certain patterns to get points. It's a pretty cool game. My mom got that, actually, and I played that with her. Azul, A-Z-U-L. Brian, thanks for giving that a shot. We have some more to share from our colleagues here at WPR. Who haven't I mentioned yet? Oh, Andrew Carlson, community engagement manager at PBS Wisconsin, says, oh, my favorite board game these days is Root. It's an asymmetrical strategy game. The art and lore is so much fun to me. It is set in a forest. Each faction of woodland creatures has a different goal and backstory. That's what I want to try. Some of my buddies out of the state love that. Say I should get it to play it online with them. So maybe, Andrew, I will give that a try sometime. Cindy joins us now in Madison. Cindy, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What game do you have for us today?
Well, we have been playing a game called Rummy Royale for the last probably 40 years as a family. And now we've passed it on to our children and grandchildren. So it's definitely a family tradition.
Now,
it's kind of two games in one. The first part of the game is a poker game. And you play with a mat and you put pennies around the playing cards. And then whoever wins the poker game gets the kitty, and then you start the second part of the game. So it's hours and hours of fun. playing for pennies makes it fun, too. So.
Excellent. And do you keep a running score, or do you keep do you write down the scores and keep them for posterity, Cindy?
Oh, yeah. We keep those scores in our Rummy Royale box.
Excellent.
And then we also, if you have to borrow pennies from the banker, we keep track of that as well too.
And are you the champion, or is there like somebody who's the, you know, the player to beat in your family?
I'd say probably my mother, who is now 87 years old.
She's the queen of Rummy Royale.
Yeah, that, and she cheats.
Oh, okay. But people let her get away with it?
No, but you know, don't stop her.
Hey, you got to catch her first, I guess. Cindy, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Great story. I love it. Emily Ralph, operations manager here at WPR, says, in our house, we absolutely love Connect 4. We have the standard plastic one. Then for Christmas this year, my wife got me a nice wooden one, which is really cool. When it's nice outside, we play a bunch on our patio. Oh, that's cool. Connect 4. What was the ad? Pretty sneaky, sis. Hey, there is still time for you to share your favorite board games and card games and more. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. If we can get a couple few on there, I'll mention them over the course of this next week. Again, email your favorite board games, ideas@WPR.org. And thanks to everybody who called in today. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the U.S. government is challenging the Apple Corporation along with attorneys general in multiple states, including Wisconsin. They allege that the company uses a monopoly position to overcharge the creators of apps, ultimately hurting consumers. Find out what's at stake, what it means for you if you are a customer of Apple and the apps that come along with it. And there's a new healthcare landscape in western Wisconsin after hospital and clinic closures in that part of the state. We'll find out what that means for people seeking health care in that part of Wisconsin. You can join in with your own experiences. You can get started right now. Actually, email ideas@WPR.org. That and more. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.